Right, so the landscape of enterprise applications. What I'm going to try and do is give you a personal view based on a whole career's worth of experience of what's important about enterprise applications, how they hang together, and what some issues are as I see them. And you may obviously have different views, so if you do, I'm happy to hear from you. Right, so here's a graphic of what a typical web application might look like. And the first question is there a problem? If we can build web applications like this, is that enough? Can we say that's it? That's how you build enterprise applications, no more debate. This actually happens to be approximately the architecture of a rather well-known web application. Anybody guess what it is? There is a clue here on the chart. It's eBay, right. And I have had direct contact with the account team for that in the past, so I can argue fairly successfully that it certainly was the architecture a few years ago, even if it isn't today. Okay? But why would you use that architecture? And is that the answer to the world's problems, right? Well, can anybody think of anything that this architecture might not include? Well, here's some suggestions. Did you do any of these today? I think you'll find it hard to answer no. So you did do some of those things today, and the chances are that you used an enterprise system and probably a transactional system that didn't actually owe very much to the web. So there are other things going on, for sure. And one of the little exercises that I like to, this is my little plug for what I spent a lot of my career doing, doing software for mainframe servers, and it turns out there are a lot of them still around, even though you don't hear much about them. But my little exercise for you, a little thought experiment, is how many transactions did you do today? Any guesses? We used to have this little thought experiment, which is how many computers have you got? And when I did it in my class at the university, it was, oh, well, I've got two. I'm a really, from the smart guy, and I'd say, and nobody has a mobile phone? So we know that most people have something like 50 or 100 computers in their homes, even though they don't know about it. But how many transactions do you do in a day? Okay, well, what I did was...
There's actually quite a chain of transactions. You're doing something that appears to be fairly simple and undivisible as far as we can say.
Absolutely true.
You put your credit card in, it has to be validated.
Yeah,
then
yeah.
Then you have to put your PIN in, that has to be validated. Then you put your account in, or whatever you like.
Right, so there's a lot of message interchanges, but if you look at the average supermarket transaction, for example, there is a buying transaction, which is you buying something from the supermarket, and there is a banking transaction, which is the funds transfer, which is you transferring funds from your card to the supermarket, and those are actually separate transactions. To get to this meeting, I bought a train ticket. That was a transaction. I then put it in a turnstile to get onto the platform. That was another transaction. I put it in the turnstile at the other end. I got to London, made several journeys on the tube. You know, so there's a lot of transactions just there.
If you've got your mobile, it just lost cells when you're in.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether that goes to the mainframe or to...
I don't think that's logged as a transaction, but there's certainly a billing transaction whenever you make a call, right? And I've worked with some of the mobile companies on their transaction monitor systems, and I know they have pretty high transaction rates. BT, for example, obviously bills records every call and puts it on your bill. So there's lots of transactions that go on in the background. Electricity, water, well, at the moment, the one transaction that you make is the one when you actually pay the bill at the end of the quarter. But in the future, we are supposed to be going to have smart metering, and the electricity meter will actually send back your usage through the network, through the electricity network, and The pricing will be determined by the current price of electricity, and so there's going to be a lot more transactions. So there are, you know, literally trillions of transactions happening in the world every day, and a lot of them are going through non-web interfaces, which is the point of this. Okay, so there is a lot of other stuff going on. Sorry, I did, yeah. Yeah, and I hope it's still running. Okay. So that's stuff that's already happening, and we know that we don't have the web picture doesn't give us a complete picture of that. Here's, you know, I don't know if you've seen this. This is Microsoft's advert that is plastered all over the tube and the newspapers and everything, and it says, transform the flexibility to build and run something applications more easily. That's cloud power, and there's a whole lot of stuff on this, but it's very hard to deduce, at least it's very hard for me to deduce what it actually does. Everyone's heard of cloud computing, everyone knows that it's going to be big, but this doesn't actually tell you what it does. In fact, I got the impression that Microsoft is using clockwork computers, but I might be wrong on that. So there is something there, but we're not quite sure what. Okay, so I thought I'd start with a much more basic look at this. What actually is an enterprise or an enterprise system? Okay, and here's my first question, which is, what's a system? Okay, well, if you look at systems theory and so on, you get this sort of picture, which is, a system is some collection of things with an internal organization. They're supposed to belong together in some way, possibly including subsystems, and it's defined by its inputs and outputs. Inputs could be information, energy, physical materials. Outputs could be the same sort of things. Okay, so I've got here an extremely interesting example of a system. This comes in a Christmas cracker. It's called a racing reindeer. And you wind it up, and it's got a clear functionality. Right, so it's a very simple system. What's the input? Well, it's a bit of potential energy, isn't it? And the output, a bit of kinetic energy, which turns into heat eventually. So that's about it, you know, energy in, energy out. Not much internal organization there as far as I can see. So I would argue that's not a very interesting system, but this one is a much more interesting system. It's rather beat up wristwatch, because this has a control function in it, which means that it doesn't just run down zoop like that. It actually runs at a controlled rate. Yes, as, you know, old watches used to have balance wheels. Now we've got quartz crystals or whatever it is. So there is a control mechanism there that is controlling the operation of it. And not only that, it's actually telling me the real time. So it's actually a real-time system, because it tells me the time before I've lost interest in that. Which is the definition of a real-time system, is it gives you the answer before you've lost interest in the question.
That's not the usual definition of a system. The usual definition is, it's something that is more than the sum of its parts. You can't deduce its function.
All right, that's good. That's good. That's good.
That's the classical definition of system.
Okay, so I'm happy to add that, John. I've tried to sort of capture a flavour of that, but it's about saying, it's got an internal organisation, it's a set of things that somehow belong together, and that's a very good point.
It's Peter Checkland is the sort of modern writer.
I shall write that down.
I don't remember. The originator of the term is a German, and I forgot his name just a moment.
But you're quite right. It's more than the sum of its parts. Right, okay. And I've just simply pointed out that there are all sorts of systems, physical, chemical, biological, social systems, and a lot of them, and they all exhibit dynamic behavior. That's what's interesting about them, and a lot of them are real time in the sense that I just described. Okay. Now, what's an enterprise? Well, an enterprise is actually a system. It's a social system, but it's a system. To increase battery lifespan, it's recommended you set your battery charges up. Go away. Thank you, Microsoft. Right, so it is actually a system. It's a social system, and it takes in... I don't care.
Just click in the slide.
Yeah, right, well done. Right, except that I want to go back, did I? Right, so it takes in inputs which are information, including finance is a form of information, labour, energy, materials, services from other organisations, and it puts out product services and all sorts of other stuff. Okay, so you can look at an enterprise as a system, and an enterprise has a control function, which is called management, and it obviously has to have an internal organization, possibly including subsystems, and related pairs of inputs and outputs are often referred to as transactions, because what enterprises typically do is buy and sell. So I pay money, you give me a service or a product. That's a transaction. Yeah. So that the only thing that is, you know, the only additional idea that an enterprise is really introducing is the idea that you do things as transactions. Okay? So what's an interesting enterprise? Because a corner shop is an enterprise, and I well remember as a lad being sent by my mother along to the local corner shop to buy groceries, and standing waiting, it was all serviced across the counter, and standing waiting for the lady at the counter to finish chatting to the customer in front of me before she would actually get on and serve my order. And the only systems involved were a sheet of paper on the counter with a pencil. So that wasn't a very interesting enterprise from any point of view. But obviously today's supermarkets do things in a very different way and use lots of systems. So I would say that an enterprise is not really interesting unless it does at least some of these things. Large numbers of customers, large numbers of transactions, large financial throughputs, complex behavior, and sustainable operation. A business that goes bust in a week is not very interesting, right? So one that stays around is more interesting. And I've summarized that as high scale for an extended period. And these are the kind of businesses that will need systems. Okay. Hi, Bill. A lot of people will say, okay, there's small and medium scale business and they use information systems. Why aren't you mentioning them? Why aren't you interested in them? And my statement is, I will say two things. The first of which is that most of what small business does is a subset of what big business does. So I can ignore it because it's a subset of the problem. Okay? And there is another reason, but I'll come to that in just a moment. Okay? So I'm going to define an enterprise system as the automated part of an enterprise, which, when you think about it, is kind of obvious.
You put boundaries. This is one of the problems in defining systems.
Yeah.
Because there's a famous thing, open systems versus closed systems.
Yes, that's true. I think you're absolutely right, John. Where is the boundary is a very good question when you start looking at enterprise systems. One interesting example, this is perhaps a bit of a tangent, but when you do your classic SQL query and you come up with some query results from your database and you print them on a report and you present it to your manager and say, that's it. If he then comes back and says, prove to me that this is real, that this data is actually real, the steps you have to go through include the step not only of saying where was the data collected from transactional input, but when you backed up the database, did you actually change anything? And there's a human step there involved somewhere along the line, where if the humans didn't do the right thing, you're going to get the wrong answer. Yeah? So there's a very interesting question, where's the boundary of the system? The boundary may include people, even in things that we think of as technical. Okay? But that's not my point here. My point is much simpler, which is just simply to say there's a collection of hardware and software which we define as an enterprise system. It includes some of the control function, but probably not all of it, because there are some controls that we do automate, but probably not all of them. If we could automate all of them, well, we wouldn't need all these managers. And that's what I'm going to call the enterprise system. There are some things that I'm going to ignore. I'm going to ignore the telephone system. I'm going to ignore the email system, because usually it has not much to do with the core operation of the business. Okay? So I'm talking about the things that actually run the day-to-day transactions of the business as the enterprise system. And I'm going to add one more statement to that, which is up there, which is that it's a real-time model of the enterprise, or at least some of the enterprise. Hi, come on in. Now, I've already argued that a lot of systems are real-time, and I'm going to argue here that enterprises themselves are real-time, and their systems need to be real-time, because otherwise they won't do what we need. Okay? And when I say a model of the system, a model of the enterprise, I mean quite a few things there too. There's quite a lot in that, which means things like, for example, in the enterprise system, there is something that represents something that is a real part of the enterprise, like the product that you're selling, for example. And it's too long a discussion to go into what the correspondence is between the model and the reality of the enterprise. I'm just simply saying that is a key part of the enterprise system, that it represents something that is actually real and is actually happening. And models have static parts, which are data, typically, that you store in databases, which represent things that the enterprise knows about, and database people spend no end of time talking about that. But it also represents processes, things that happen, things that you do, which, of course, are the things that run the business.
Is there a scope here for having multiple views of the same thing, according to whether you're the finance director or the IT director?
Well, now, isn't that interesting? You see, the thing is, if you've got multiple views, the question was, is there scope for multiple views of the enterprise? If you've got multiple views of the enterprise, what is it that tells you that they actually refer to the same enterprise? Do they have anything to do with each other? Hopefully they do. And if they do, then clearly it must be possible to derive one view from another view. In other words, if the data that the finance director is working with isn't somehow derived from the real operational transactions in the business, then it isn't worth a lot. That could happen, of course.
We've got the banking crisis that way.
Yeah.
Toxic
right.
Mortgages.
Okay, so pressing right along, moving right along. Just a quick aside, where would you find an enterprise system? Well, you probably wouldn't find it here. You think about those industries, you don't find very many systems in them, right? And you might find it here, right? We talked about transport and transport systems and so on. Everybody knows that enterprise systems are used in manufacturing, so you might find it there, and you would quite likely find it here in the service part of the economy, especially financial and business services. So if you just think about the types of systems that you come in contact with, some of the ones that I've mentioned earlier on, you're quite likely to find them in that part of the industry. In other words, they tend to be a feature of a service-oriented economy rather than of an old-fashioned primary economy.
It's an ecosystem. I mean, it's called a system because, you know, the sun and the rain and the plants and the seasons, all...
They're all systems,
they have
yes.
Relationships.
They do, but we don't... You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. The point there that John was making is that ecosystems are systems themselves and we depend on them, but we don't have information systems tracking them. At least we didn't used to. Now we do, because we're tracking the climate and we're obviously trying to get to the point where we can actually manage the climate.
Yeah. I think if you talk to almost any farmer, it's a one-man operation, that he would say agriculture is a business and it runs just like any other business. Inputs and outputs and cash flow.
characterize any. I agree with you. Right, so David's point is agriculture is a business like any other business. But is it a corner shop or is it a supermarket?
Well, yeah, okay. It depends entirely on the scale.
So yes.
You do have
right.
Farms, you have 100 man farms.
Yeah. So, all right, let's not be too black and white about this, but I'm just trying to give a good impression. Right, so a brief history of enterprise systems. This is very brief because I've listed a few events which I consider to be pioneering events in information systems. The first one is obviously the one that happened here in London when Joe Lyons in the 50s, I may not have the precise date correct, but it was around then, when Joe Lyons' company, their corner shops as they used to be, decided to start using computers to automate their operation, their financial operations, and that is well recorded, well documented as the first commercial use of computers. The computers they used were actually based on the EDSAC from Cambridge, and the UK was indeed the world leader at the time in commercial computing. What they were doing, they would automate the collection of till receipts, billing, accounting, and
cupcakes as well.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And all that stuff. And of course, no, that's fine. You're absolutely right. The point that I didn't realize until I started doing this talk is that accounting systems are real-time systems. We hardly ever think about that. They are actually real-time systems. If you don't get your accounts done by the end of the day, the end of the week, the end of the quarter, whatever it is, then actually you have difficulties running your company, right? That's the purpose of accounts, to actually give you feedback on whether you're still financially viable, and to give that feedback in a, quote, timely, unquote, manner. In other words, before you've lost interest in the question. So they are real-time systems, although we don't really think about that. Now, next one, American Airlines Sabre System, and I have this fascinating book here, James Martin, Programming Real-Time Computer Systems, dated, 1965, right? And this is not American Airlines Sabre, but here is the British European Airways reservation clerk in London operating a automatic seat reservation system controlled by two UNIVAC real-time computers.
That was Beacon.
Yes. Right. And he actually gives an architecture diagram of large commercial system, e.g. airline reservation system. Yeah, of course it is. Yeah. Anybody not seen a punch card before?
Still promoting that.
Actually, it's not a punch card because it hasn't got the corner taken off. And when I first started as a research student trying to build a system to manage physics experiments at the accelerator up in Harwell, this was all I had to go on. That was practically the only published thing about how you could build a real-time system. There were not even operating systems at that stage. Everything was all one big mass. So that was interesting. And I think that it was at that period when people started talking about online, real-time, transaction-based systems. Okay, and of course, it might interest you to know that some parts of the Sabre system are still running. Right?
By the way, CCS, I think, is some early airline reservations.
Thank you, David. Some early airline reservations. Right. Yes. Well, I think I know quite a bit about them already. So. Yeah. Right. The airline reservations were not the only people doing that kind of thing, but they were one of the standout examples. And it is fascinating to know that some parts of the Sabre system are still running, using what these days is called the transaction processing facility, used to be called the airline control system. And I did hear that they were trying to, American Airlines would quite like to get off it because it's quite an expensive system to maintain. But for the moment, it's true that when you go onto your snazzy travel agent website, Skyscanner, I think, was the last one I used, and you find out about flights from A to B, and you try and book them, and so on, you're actually, in the end, you're using the damn bits of the old Sabre system. It's all happening on mainframes, right? All right, so let's fast forward to 1993, and I picked out Amazon as the company that really broke through in terms of doing direct marketing to customers over the web. The word is disintermediation, cutting out all the middlemen in the process, just selling the book straight to you and delivering it from a big warehouse. Now, at the same time, there were lots of other people. Here's another interesting book, Reengineering the Corporation, which is by two guys called Michael Hammer and James Champy. Michael Hammer was a database guy at one time. And they were talking about how enterprise systems had to be made much more responsive. They're talking about the fact that it was no good to, when you order something, to go through umpteen manual steps or even computerized steps where you hand off things from one system to another system to another system, and it takes a week to get the answer, right? That's not very real time. Or at that stage, people were beginning to realize that it wasn't very real time. And there was tremendous interest in people, in companies who already had these enterprise systems, in trying to actually link them all together, integrate them, and make them much more responsive. And I interpret that, in the end, as a realization that you have to get closer to your customer and more responsive to your customer, which is the thing that Amazon absolutely did in spades. You went on the website, you went through a catalogue of, you know, thousands upon thousands of books, you found the one you wanted, you looked at, you know, several different offers about which copy you might want to buy, you selected one, and they told you, they took your money, they told you straight away when it was going to be delivered, which is pretty close to as real time as you can get. Yeah.
They go back to other shops and other warehouses which are not owned by Amazon. So there's a back system which keeps an index of,
yes,
is that an inventory,
right,
of what is actually stored in this.
So a very good point here, John, thank you for bringing it up, which is that Amazon, although Amazon do have vast warehouses and they do deliver direct from their own warehouses, they're actually doing more of a job than that because they're keeping track of other suppliers as well. And yes, you're right, there's Amazon Market, there are people who sell secondhand books through Amazon. So it's actually even a bigger system than just what Amazon itself does. But I think the key points here are the direct customer service and the just-in-time delivery. Okay. Right, so we'll fast forward again. There was the whole dot-com boom after that, which is all sorts of people trying to emulate Amazon, some failing, some succeeding. And then we got to the Google era, when all of a sudden Google broke through, and again, I may not have the date precisely correct, but Google broke through as clearly the best search engine. And what was remarkable about Google was that not only would they find you the result you wanted, but they would do it faster than anybody else, and they would actually tell you what the response time was, you know, what fraction of a second it was, at the time when the other search engines were still taking 4 or 5 seconds. And they did this by deploying massive computing resources and using massive amounts of data to actually base their search results on. And what's interesting about that is that they were using supercomputing techniques for what are essentially transaction-based operations. Okay, I don't want to be confusing here, because there's two parts to what Google does. Google crawls around the web, and that's an offline operation from most points of view, and it tabulates the results of that, and then it makes them available for online search. And that is essentially another form of transaction, even though we don't normally think of it as a transaction. That's what it is, okay? And I don't know if you've used Google recently and noticed that as you type on the input line, character by character, it's coming back with suggestions for what your search term might be. So it's actually, and this is only within the last couple of years that they've been doing this. Do they? Okay, I haven't used them. But the point is, single character is now generating several transactions that are coming back with potential search terms that you might want before you actually decide on the actual thing that you want to.
George,
so that
George Galouris pointed this out. I mean,
yes, he did.
Every character key depression then generates an HTTP request.
Yes.
Rather than just finally.
Precisely, and so. We're getting character by character transactions. If you've done a Google search, you've probably done a dozen transactions, you know, just in that. Isn't that interesting? Or maybe it's very boring, but all right. So, and then my last one is but I think this is a new way of doing stuff. And very few other companies have actually got even close to thinking about this scale of operation, right? And the last one is the Apple iPhone for the obvious reason that that's changed the whole world of mobile. Now you can actually do relatively useful and sensible things on mobiles that before you really could only do on desktop machine laptops. And that opens up, again, this is getting closer to the customer. It's opening up the whole world of I can do a transaction anytime I like, anywhere I like, using any gadget I like, which is obviously where we're headed.
I don't know. I'm just saying, the other day I was sitting in and a young lady decided she took out the laptop, opened it, plugged in what was obviously a USB modem, typed a bit, and then took out her phone, smartphone, and she used that. And I was so intrigued, why did she need to use two devices? Well, as she was getting off, I couldn't resist just asking her. And it was because she composed some email on the smartphone, but wanted to send it through the laptop because the systems are not fully integrated. That was the thing. I didn't get all the details because she had
right.
To train, but what I'm saying is we are now in an era where the lack of integration of the business systems in one machine that's used in our day, that has now gone over to the lack of integration in the various kinds of online services that you get.
Right, so can I just summarise as that? As
it's a very good chat up.
Yes, very good. Can I? Yeah. I'd love to know what you're doing with your smartphone. Right. Yes, can I just summarize what John said as lack of integration between systems and add to that, yes, that the mobile system is really becoming real, and it's actually often quicker to do it through your mobile than through the laptop. We went to Kensington today to buy some music, and my wife said, what's the address of the music shop? Oh, well, pull out the smartphone, do a Google search, there's the answer. Right, sorry, you were...
Yeah, you know the character transaction was generated?
Yeah.
What are the implications?
The implications are a lot of MIPS, a lot of power, compute power being burnt in the background.
To the end
user, it's just much more responsive, faster, more responsive. Yeah. Or more... Because they make suggestions for search terms, you probably will get to what you want quicker. In the past...
I think it's less accurate because it throws up results when you put in partial...
But then one of them might be what you want. One of them might be what you want, in which case you go straight to it.
Because I find it quicker because it tends to bring up about, say, 10 things on the screen.
Yeah.
And quickly glance through them and immediately, that's it.
That's it. That's clearly their intention, to be more responsive.
Yeah. And it remembers what...
Yes. Let's move on. Go on, Roger. Because
very quick point. I think in terms of enterprise systems, you would have to make a very strong case to include, and I guess it has to be eBay, but auction systems, interestingly, possibly you could argue for games systems, simply because if you take eBay, what it's done is to revolutionize is the concept of the enterprise. That most of these systems, you have a classic guy in the middle who, in a sense, physically or logically, orders stock into a virtual or real warehouse and then supplies it, Amazon. The thing about eBay is, in a sense, you have completely distributed suppliers and customers.
We didn't, right. So can I...
I don't want to pursue...
No, can I summarise that?
It's a very different enterprise with a massive amount of IT.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. And the...
structure, but it's just, I think...
Yes. When I first came into contact with eBay, which is in the almost a decade ago, their transaction rates were already 35 million a day, which was higher than almost anything else. Okay, there were things like UPS parcel tracking was something like 70 million transactions a day, but very simple transactions. It was a very, very high rate transaction system, and it was all hand cobbled together on web technology with no understanding of transactions at all. So we've got to take systems like that seriously. I didn't mention it because your point that it revolutionizes the enterprise, I am not completely sure that is true. And I think that's a...
Well, let's take it down the wine
I think bar. That's a wine bar discussion, okay?
And also,
what they started off as a pure auction model, and supposedly it was entirely between the buyer and the seller and they were not involved. But as time goes by, they've got more and more involved in policing it and all kinds of other activities. Yes, yes. And that was a smart thing to do.
Yeah.
But if you think about things like, you know, Pirate Bay and the illegal downloads of music, they're in a situation that is a little bit similar to eBay in that they claim that they're merely past pairing up buyers and sellers.
I might look at transactions
right?
in interactive but games.
Yeah, well, games is another thing, right?
Let's not distract.
Right, because I'm not sure games are enterprise systems even today. But, Pirate Bay, they're pairing buyers and sellers. Well, that's exactly what stock market systems do. It's not fundamentally different.
I was going to say, we've had brokers for a long time.
Exactly. Yeah. Right, so this highly simplistic graph here certainly says that as we went through the decades, we evolved through system types from batch, online, networked, web, and now social stroke mobile. What I detect is a theme of getting closer and more responsive to the customer all the way through that. The time was when the customer never saw the enterprise system. Only the employees saw the enterprise system. Now the enterprise system is openly visible to the customer. And in the case of something like Google, it's the whole of what the customer uses. And therefore, the importance of the systems has become much greater. And the customer orientation is actually a key element of what they do.
I'm not sure that's right about Google. There's a whole part of Google you haven't mentioned, which is its advertising.
Yeah.
And that is actually hidden from the customer.
Well, I haven't...
The advertising.
I haven't talked about this business model. And I'll leave that aside for now. But, yeah, I'm sure you're right. But another wine bar topic?
Mm-hmm. What I was just going to say is, are we tipping over the edge now? As systems are starting to impose their suggestions onto the customer. So you've got, like, Google, when you're typing in a search, and it's going through its top list of results, which it probably people are paying to have on.
Right. Are we imposing answers on the customers? Hold that point, because I want to come back to it, okay? Right, now then, a very boring list of innovations, but the point I'm making here is that some of these things, like, for example, direct access storage, came into existence specifically because we started building transactional types of systems. Up to that point, everything was batch. You only processed files sequentially. You never needed to get to one record. It didn't matter. When it started mattering, we had to build direct access storage. So that's just an example of the way technology has actually been driven by the enterprise problems that we're trying to solve when we build enterprise systems. Okay? And I think you can make similar claims for this. And again, I don't want to get bogged down in this, but I'm trying to develop a theme on that. Okay. Now, what I want to do is just be technical for a moment, and I'm severely in danger of overrunning my time. And I thought I'd look at some of the program, because what's interesting to people like us is how do you build the applications, right, that actually drive these things? Well, what I've chosen to do is look at four paradigms, that terrible word, four styles of building applications. And here's one which everyone is terribly familiar with. Everyone who's ever used Unix is certainly familiar with it, but everyone who's ever used a PC is familiar with it, which is the user logs on, the operating system gives them a big lump of memory and a share of processing time, dedicated files, channels, all this stuff, and they stay there until the person decides to log off. Okay? Windows terminal server, your own PC, you know, everything, lots of things used on this. So it's a very widely used paradigm, but there's no sharing of resources. Two users can't get at the same data. Yeah? And it's absolutely dreadful when it comes to scalability. It's been proved many, many times. If you try running that kind of thing, right, try running a Unix system with more than a few hundred terminals logged on, concurrently logged on, it's going to fall apart. Well, the file and print sharing at a very coarse level. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But if you get into the locking mechanisms used, I think you'll find they're very, very coarse grained. Okay. All right. Now, so that doesn't actually work for enterprise systems because you cannot have thousands of customers using this model. It just doesn't work. Even though there were people who thought it did. I mean, this model originated in the 1960s, and time sharing, as it was then called, was quite popular for a period, and then it suddenly disappeared. It came back with Unix, and it came back with the PC. Every time there was a new technology that was cheaper than the one before, people... The paradigm came up again, and people started to think, oh, this is all we need to do. And then after a period, discovered that it really had some limits. Okay, so the next one is the good old TP monitor pseudo-conversational paradigm. And I don't know whether you're familiar with it, but this paradigm is where the TP monitor is something that sits on top of the operating system and it effectively supplants the operating system for most purposes, takes all the resources at startup time, and just give me all the memory, I want all the processing power, I'm going to have all the databases, everything belongs to me, and when you come along as a user over the network and you make a transaction request, I'll give you a little bit of it for a short period of time until you're done, and then I'll take it back again. Okay, that's the very short summary of how that works. So the user never owns anything for themselves, and particularly important is that when the end user device is idle, it owns no resources, okay, other than a communication link, right? And this does enable concurrent access to the sorts of applications that we recognize as enterprise applications, where you're using databases and you get access to one record for a short period of time while you want to read it or update it, and then it's unlocked and you know you haven't got it. So we know this is scalable. The fly in the ointment is that to program this, to build applications for this, you have to use this so-called stateless application programming, which means your application consists of a set of message pairs. Message in, do this, message out, right? And writing applications that way is really quite hard work, because when you get the message, you've got to figure out where you were in what you were trying to do. To do any kind of serious application, you actually need a conversation with the user. Right? If you're trying to do something like an internet shopping application or just a shopping application, you need to have an interchange with the user over a number of message interactions that complete a business task. And so you actually need conversations, but the strict paradigm doesn't give them to you. So there is a fudge which was in this paradigm right from the early days, which is so-called scratchpad storage, which is where at the end, after you've processed a message and you're just about to give the response back, you can squirrel away a few bytes of information in so-called scratchpad storage that you can find later. And when you get the next interaction, the program, the application program, has to go find this storage, figure out what it was doing, and then do the appropriate next response. Okay? All right. Still not necessarily a very easy programming task, but it did work. Okay. So now let's move forward to something that has had a lot of publicity in the last few years. Yes? Right. And here's this guy Fielding, who wrote his thesis on this. Here's chapters 5 and 6 of his thesis, where he talks about representational state transfer and how wonderful it is. And it's just the way to build the web. And when you look at it, you discover that it's not a whole lot different from the pseudo-conversational paradigm. What it really does is it says that we are going to run the web in such a way that, in fact, we don't even have connectivity all the time. HTTP allows you to make connection, send a request, get some data, and return that data to the client. Okay, and the state transfer bit is where the state, everything to do with that request, is given back to the client, and it's yours, and you look after it. I'm not interested. I'm going away. Bye. Okay? The representation bit comes from the statement that the only thing we deal with on the web is representations. Okay? We don't deal with underlying semantic data. It's just representations. Okay? So it could be a picture, it could be a document, it could be anything else, but it's just a representation. And you ask for this genius part of the web is the way in which we do the addressing. So a URL will find you a unique representation, and then I give it back to you. That's it. Now, this also requires stateless programming. And in fact, if it's just finding a document, then it's a standard program. Nobody needs to write any applications. As we know, this is the document web of, you know, more than a decade ago. It's highly scalable to tens or hundreds of thousands of users. We do know that. It just, unfortunately, this stuff does get talked about a lot as you should build your web application to be RESTful. You know, I've heard this several times. But actually, it doesn't deal with applications at all. It specifically says you can't have cookies because cookies mess up the pure exchange of representations. You can't depend, having lodged a cookie on somebody's browser, you can't actually depend on the meaning of that at some later time. But cookies are a form of scratchpad storage, and they are stored on the client rather than on the server. But the whole idea of a cookie is that you give it back, and the server application can then figure out where it was and decide what to do next. So despite the fact that people quote RESTful, and here's, you know, here's a nice little book, which I picked up 2 or 3 months ago, RESTful Java with JAX-RS. And this guy, Bill Burke, is describing how to build Java server applications using RESTful principles, and claiming that that's the answer. I think the true answer is what the web does is brilliant, but to build applications on top of it, you do need some extra stuff. And today, that's still, even today, that's still relatively pragmatic. There isn't the one obvious, clear, right way to do it. People are still looking at, you know, still working with a number of different ways of doing it. So, unfortunately, that is not quite the answer to all the questions, right? So now let's look at Google, which we've already talked about, but uses a thing called Google Application Engine, and lo and behold, it requires stateless clients. Because it's stateless, it can scale to very, very large numbers of users. So there's a very common theme coming through here, right? Now, however, we do, you know, in the stuff that we were talking about, where Google makes suggestions and you choose, there is some state involved in that. You are actually having a conversation with Google, and Google has got to be able to store this data somewhere, and it stores it in this thing called Bigtable, which is an in-memory file, which is backed by this thing called Google File System. And what the purpose of that is that if your first HTTP request gets an answer and comes back, right, when you make your second HTTP request, it might go somewhere completely different in Google's server farm, might go to a completely different server. How does that server find the state that is needed to decide how to complete your search? And the answer is it has to be somewhere where all the servers can get at it, and that's the Google File System, which is a file system that is designed so that every node in a huge cluster can actually get at this file system. Okay? So there's some clever stuff there, but the interesting stuff is that this, you know, you look at what Google does, it's really good for applications that use read-only data. No, when you communicate with Google, whatever IP address you use is then going to be routed to some server, but you have no idea which server it is. Okay, there's some kind of load balancing thing going on, and you don't know which server it's going to end up at, and neither do they ahead of time. In fact, you don't even know it's going to be a server in the same country, right? Which is all very clever stuff. You have to be storing something on your browser that goes back to Google that tells it who you are, or tells it particularly, you know, where you were in your search. I frankly don't know, but it's something like that. So all these methods depend on moving state backwards and forwards between the client and the server. Okay, you run something that is a transaction. You return some data to the client. Part of that data is some state data. The next time the client talks to the server, they actually send this state data back, and that enables them to find the scratchpad storage, which enables you to continue the conversation.
It's big, so the user is dragged across the boundary into the system. That's what it means.
The user themselves.
The user's part of the system.
User's part of the system. Well, the user's client system is part of the system, yes.
The client
is part of the system,
so
yes.
Out over the boundary and outside the system.
Yeah.
But the scratch pad is, as it were, what Google needs to know about. It's a kind of model of the user as far as Google's concerned.
Scratchpad is the model of the user. Yes, I think that's probably a fair statement. Right. Now, my point here is that Google File System is very good at sharing Scratchpad data amongst a large number of users, but this actually only works if most of the data is read-only. Try doing high-volume database access through it, and it isn't going to work because the locking, the contention that is implied by update traffic isn't going to work in this model. And that's why, surprisingly enough, you know, Google Search, Google Maps, Google, what is it, aerial photographs, what they're called, Google Earth, and all the rest of it is all read-only data. Google Street View, it's all read-only data. Although Google, I get the feeling that they themselves think that they're about to take over the world of enterprise applications, I suggest that is probably a long way off, because they can't do the things that we actually need to do in commercial applications. Right, so why do these paradigms work? Well, they all embody the many-to-one relationship between customers and the enterprise. There's no peer-to-peer stuff in it. It's all me to them, them to me, okay? And they all use stateless programming to provide scalable concurrency, and because they provide that, they allow the enterprise to exploit economies of scale. It's as simple as that. Yeah? You can't afford to do a Google search for one person. Nobody could afford to do that. But because you're only using a tiny bit of it for a tiny fraction of time, they can afford to do it for the whole world. Yeah? But none of these does everything that we need in an enterprise system, which is why we're still building our own enterprise applications. We still have other things to worry about. Now, I'm really running late, so I'm going to do a couple of things, okay? I'm going to conclude this part of the talk by saying stateless applications work really well for read-only requests, and even in commercial applications, we have inquiry-type transactions, okay? What is the current value of stock XYZ is a typical example in a, you know, internet stockbroker, for example. What's the price? And it works really well for that. But in the real parts of commercial applications like web stocking, web shopping or stock trading or anything else you care to think of, where we need update operations, we need a set of things. Okay, we're probably going to use something like HTTP because that's still a very, very good communication mechanism. And there was a period when people believed that the object-based protocols like IOP would be the perfect way of communicating between a client and a server, a web client and a server. It didn't happen, right? And there are lots of good reasons for that. And Fielding's thesis explains lots of the good reasons why that wouldn't work, okay? So we're not going to have a remote procedure call as the communication method. We use, have something much more like HTTP. But we also need to do these things. We need to hold state on the client or a replicated server file system. Okay, we do need that as part of the architecture. And we also need to design our applications in such a way that we limit our concurrency requirements by, for example, collecting updates together. Think of a web shopping application. You can collect all the basket stuff and then finally do the real updates, the commit part of the transaction, as a single transaction at the end of a long dialogue. That sort of thing will help a lot to increase the concurrency that you can get in that type of application. Okay, so that, without giving, you know, a detailed programming example, that's my recipe for how to build high-scale enterprise applications. Right, now I was going to spend a few minutes just looking at enterprise challenges, and I think I can do that fairly quickly, okay? If you talk to business people, they only care about two things, which are these, okay? Reduce costs and increase revenue. That's all they care about. And I would suggest, I don't want to spend any time on this, but I would suggest that cloud computing is mainly about this today. If you look at the actual offerings in cloud computing, you'll find that they think do things like, well, you don't have to have all the servers. You can actually have some servers in the cloud and you can use them when you want. Okay? You don't have to have all the storage. You can have storage in the cloud and you can get more when you want it and you can use it when you want it. So they're all about these operational expense things. And they're real. They're not unimportant. Because, for example, there are a lot of real retail companies that do most of their business in the few weeks just before Christmas. So it makes no sense to have vast systems sitting around all year when you're only going to use them for a few weeks. But in those few weeks, you need your peak capacity. And if you hit the max on your systems, you're in big trouble because you can't handle the orders. So it makes sense to not own those things, but to take them from some...
Everybody has Christmas support at the same time.
Yeah, but that's a problem for, you know, who's the cloud supplier of choice, right? It could be Amazon, it could be Google, it could be IBM, it could be Oracle. So far, it isn't Microsoft, that's for sure. Right, so, but these things, that they're not unimportant, but at the moment, they are mainly about reducing costs, and that's why they're interesting at the moment, I would claim. There are other aspects of cloud computing or web services that are about re-architecting business processes. And I'm not, I think I'm going to just pass over that for the moment. But again, they're interesting, but they're not where the focus is today. Okay? So the other thing is increasing revenue. And the only ways of increasing revenue are you get new customers, you keep your existing customers, and you get more business from your existing customers, what's called greater wallet share. Okay? So how could you do that? What do you need to do in applications to actually do any of those things? Well, you know, fast responsive applications, that's a good start. Yeah, that's right. So I'm going to suggest, and this is just something for you to take away and think about or argue about or talk about in the wine bar, that these are some of the things that we're still not terribly good at, but they do actually matter in designing enterprise applications. First one is multi-channel applications, acting consistently to the customer. Now, what's a channel? Oh, well, let me just go through the list. Multi-business service, effective. All right, I'm going to go through each of these just briefly. Channel. A channel is the way you reach the customer. Okay? And these are all examples of channels. And some businesses operate through many different channels. Right? Take your bank, for example. It has branch offices. It has kiosks, which are known as ATMs. It has mobile banking, internet banking, telephone banking, right? It has all these darn channels. Now, here's the question. To what extent do things look the same, whichever channel you use? And to what extent do they look different? Well, the businesses might well say, if you use internet, I'll charge you less. The stockbrokers do that, for example, because you don't need as many people involved. So that's fair enough. But what about what the customer actually sees? If you went to your bank account and you saw the bank balance in the internet, and then you went to the ATM and asked for the balance there and it was different, you'd be kind of upset, wouldn't you? Yes, this would not really seem good. And that's very interesting because the ATMs, Bill will remember, the ATMs used to give you yesterday's balance, didn't they? They used to give you yesterday's balance. It took a lot of work for the ATMs to actually give you up-to-date balance. And the reason for that is simple. All the banking transactions used to be copied to a separate server that actually ran the ATM network so that the ATM query load didn't impact the transactional system that was processing your checks.
I think that wasn't technology. I think that this is the way we've always done it. Abbey National
could
give you
your balance. Right. Abbey National could give
it.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
They didn't do it that way.
Well, they didn't have to go through the clearing network for another thing, right? All right, so whether you call it technology or whether you call it culture, they certainly weren't very good at that kind of stuff. And neither were the stock markets. It used to take 3 or 4 days to clear a stock trade from the point when the trade was agreed on the exchange to the point when everything that, all the paperwork, everything that had needed to be done had been completed. Okay, and we can go into detail on that if anyone wants to. But my point is these speeding up this cycle was sometimes referred to as T plus zero settlement. In the stock markets, it was referred to as T plus zero settlement, meaning you settled the same day as the trade was made, and then you can go to the internet and you can look at your stock account and it actually tells you what the current state is. So there, this is a long roundabout way of saying that as a customer, I don't care which customer channel I use, I want it to look the same. Yeah. Now Google achieves that perfectly. I can do a search on my mobile and it looks exactly the same as doing a search on my desktop, right? No problem. But these channels, it's clearly more tricky if you've got different delivery mechanisms, if it's technically different. If the ATM network, for example, is technically different from the network through which I'm delivering the internet banking, there are problems to solve there. And there are a couple of approaches. One approach is to say it's all going to be web. The ATMs are going to be on the web. I don't care, you know, if I make it web, then I only have to write the application once, everything's simple. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't work. I think I'm right saying the ATMs are still a different network, because the standard of encryption they use is much higher than we typically use on the web. Okay? But my point is, these are issues that people need to think about. And when you structure applications, you clearly need to structure the presentational bit of it that the customer sees independently of the business logic bit that actually deals with the request and how the request is satisfied. Yeah? Very important design consideration. And you often, when you look at the existing applications, you often find they were written for a particular channel and they just don't work with a different channel. That's very true of telephone call center type applications. Yeah? So there's work to do there. That's my point. And it's all about the customer. Treat the customer consistently. Okay, here's my second bit. M squared refers to multi-channel, multi-business. The classic example here is the utility companies. When they had their big deregulation in the 90s, electricity companies were allowed to buy gas companies were allowed to buy electricity companies, water companies could buy anything they liked, right? You could get all these things from one company. And they still struggled, I would suggest, to actually exploit that in a real sense. The first question that all of them realized that they were open to was that when you phone up the call center of Scottish and Southern Energy or wherever your favorite supplier is and say, please tell me the amount outstanding on my electricity bill. Let's hope they can answer the question. And you say, and what about my gas bill? How much is outstanding on that? Oh, I've no idea. It's a different system. Can't look at that. You know, doesn't look very good. So you have systems here which already exist because they're huge billing systems, and you can call them legacy systems if you like. They're systems that exist that we aren't going to rewrite because there's no percentage in doing that. Okay? But somehow we want to make them look as if we're all one company. Okay? And there is a piece of magic here which I've turned an integration server which somehow helps us to do that. Now, in some cases, it's very simple integration, just taking a request and routing it, and taking the response and routing it. So that you only have to use one customer ID, one customer account number, and I can look at two different pieces of business. Sometimes it's a lot more than that. Yeah? But this is clearly an important element in trying to look like one business to the customer. And you know, an awful lot of businesses are conglomerates of one sort or another. So it is a real issue. And you know, the Amazon example, we've got Amazon delivered from Amazon's website, and we've got Amazon Market, and they do a good job of making it look pretty similar. You don't need to know about a different billing system to use that, right? And so on and so on. So it can be done. Right. So now, interestingly enough, that architecture there suggests that we might have separate servers, separate systems for dealing with particular channels if there are things in those channels that are unique that we have to deal with in a particular way. Okay. We might have particular back-end systems that deal with particular lines of business if there's something unique about that. But somehow in the middle we've got to have a funnel or something that actually glues the whole thing together. And you end up with this three-tier architecture, which is surprisingly pervasive. And isn't it interesting? That's just what the picture I showed you at the beginning. But I have at least explained some of why we have that picture. Okay? Now then, and I'll try and finish as quickly as I can. The good web systems are not just simple transactional systems. They allow you to do a lot of stuff around the transaction, like checking out lots of prices, looking at different product options, you know, before you actually decide what you're going to buy, different configurations maybe. And they also do other things afterwards. They get you to evaluate, you know, how was it for you? What did you think of other customers? Did you look at other customers' evaluations? You know, and all of this is about trying to enrich the customer experience. The web shopping, I mean, a decade ago, some studies of web shopping suggested that you could often get as many as 100 browse transactions to one buy transaction. So there's an awful lot of window shopping going on. Yeah, kicking the tires. People looking at possible things they might do. And I expect you do. I certainly do it. You know, looking at flights to various places. Can I get a flight there? Can I go this way? Can I get a hotel there? No, I'll try there, you know. Before you ever get close to actually saying, right, this is what I'm going to do, and commit a transaction. And the background is most people only get paid when you commit the transaction. So this is load on the system that isn't generating any money, yeah, in the narrow sense of the word. You have to get used to a different way of thinking. If you can enrich the customer, you know, if you can use this data, then you can do lots of interesting things. And Amazon is an example that tries to do it, but not very well. You know, you once bought a book on Pushkin's poetry, so maybe you'd like these 50 volumes on Russian literature. No thanks, I bought it for a present for somebody else. Right? So my point is, there's a lot to learn here, but we're not learning it very quickly. Okay? And if we can process all this data, we may be able to produce better offers to the customer. And better offers, you know, like Google search suggestions, mean faster cycles, quicker response, and hopefully more business. Okay? And I'm suggesting here that we may even need parallel computation. One of the few places where I think we actually do need parallelism. And I can give you an example. It's from many years ago, but it was an insurance company. It was a call center application, and they had the very smart idea that most people phoned their insurance company when they wanted to make a claim. The rest of the time, they didn't even bother to talk to them. So in the call center, when the call center agent got the customer on the line saying, I've crashed my car, I want to make a claim, they would then broadcast back to a whole range of these servers. Go back. No, nope, I didn't want to. No, I did it. Right. They had separate systems for life insurance, motor insurance. Yeah, it's late, isn't it?
Well, no.
Yeah, I do apologize. They had separate systems for all these different lines of business, and what they wanted to do was, in parallel, collect from these systems as much information as they could about what links they had to this customer, what relationships they had with this customer, and then use that as the basis for possible cross-selling. Saying, I noticed that, you know, I've settled your motor claim, but I noticed you haven't got any home insurance. Can I help you? So parallelism actually made sense in that context. Okay, final one. No, that's the summary. Sorry, I've done that. Right. Final one, and this is the one that all companies worry about, which is what's happening in the market that I don't know about. How do I find out what my customers really want? And we know that enterprises do a lot of stuff in this area, but I'm suggesting that it may not be very good. And if you compare that with highly parallel search over very large amounts of data in the style of Google, there's a lot more that you could learn. Okay, and my final slide is, Google's the best known exponent of this, but actually it's widely used in scientific applications. If you remember the search for extraterrestrial intelligence at home, you could download a replica of the application onto your PC and let it crawl away in the background and look at a bit of the astronomical data. Okay, and there is a very nice paper I came across, Protein Modeling with Blue Gene, which is IBM's supercomputer. And the interesting question there was, they said several months of parallel computation enabled them to simulate 10 microseconds of actual behavior of a real protein molecule, which is kind of extreme ratios, isn't it? But the